Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back. Have you ever stood at the base of a huge mountain or maybe watched a river wind its way across a valley and just thought, this isn't just scenery?
That's a story.
Exactly. A story, a slow motion epic of, I don't know, incredible violence and patience all at once. Today, we want to give you the keys to actually read that story.
We're doing a deep dive into Landscape and Geomorphology by Andrew Goody and Heather Viles. And our mission really is to help you go from just being a passive observer to becoming an informed interpreter.
I love that phrase, informed interpreter.
It's about being able to look at any feature on the Earth's surface and understand not just how it got there, but what forces are changing it, you know, right now.
And that science is called geomorphology.
That's it. The study of how Earth's surface is shaped and altered.
So you're talking about achieving landscape literacy, but why should someone care about, say, the physics of rock decay today?
Well, because the stakes have honestly never been higher. Geomorphology is it's the foundation for dealing with our most urgent planetary problems.
You mean like climate change?
Climate change adaptation, for sure. But also managing coastal erosion, predicting floods, figuring out where landslides might happen. If you want to talk about any of that seriously, you have to understand the mechanics of the land right under our feet.
So it's basically the science of planetary stability.
It is. It really is. And what makes this book so unique is the incredible expertise of the two authors.
Right. They come at it from different angles.
Completely different, but complementary. First, you have Andrew Goody, an emeritus professor at Oxford, a giant in the field. His work is all macro scale.
The big picture stuff.
The biggest picture. Large scale climate changes, desert systems, and the overwhelming impact of humanity. He was a key figure in championing the concept of the Anthropocene.
The Anthropocene. That's the idea that humans are now the main geological force on the planet. I mean, that's a huge claim.
It is a huge claim, and he grounds it in hard science. So he gives us that vast, long-term, climate-driven perspective.
Okay, so that's one half. What about the other?
Then you have Heather Viles, also an Oxford professor, and she brings this incredible microscale and biological perspective. She's a pioneer in what's called biogeomorphology.
Biogeomorphology.
Yeah.
So that's the study of how life interacts with landforms.
Exactly. And it's a two-way street, which is crucial. It's not just about how the land affects life, but how life actively changes the land.
So we're not just talking about plants growing on a hill.
Oh, not at all. Her work looks at things you might never even consider, like how microbes can actually speed up the chemical weathering of a rock, or how different organisms physically break down stone. She even uses this knowledge to help conserve historic stone buildings.
So if Goody is looking at the massive global scale of climate and humanity,
Viles is showing us that even at the level of a tiny root pushing into a crack or a single microbe, life is this active, powerful agent of change.
And putting those two together gives you a complete picture.
It really does. It's a framework that's both grand in scope and incredibly meticulous in its detail.
Okay, so let's get into the book's central idea. It says the Earth's surface is a dynamic, interconnected, open system. What does that actually mean for you and me, that the landscape is an open system?
Think of it like a huge complex and kind of leaky basin.
Okay.
It has inputs, right? Solar energy, rain, tectonic forces pushing land up. And it has output sediment being washed away by rivers, for example.
So things are always coming in and going out.
Exactly. Because it's open, it's never static. It's always trying to adjust to find some kind of equilibrium. But that equilibrium is always shifting. The landscape you see today is really just a snapshot of that continuous process.
And the engine behind all that change, that flux, is what the book calls this. This huge planet-wide conflict, a clash of titans.
It absolutely is. On one side, you've got the endogenetic forces, the internal forces. They're powered by the Earth's own heat deep inside.
These are the builders.
The builders, precisely. Volcanism, plate tectonics, earthquakes, the uplift that creates mountains. They build the raw material, the high ground.
And then on the other side, you have the forces trying to tear it all down.
The exogenetic forces, the external ones. Powered mostly by the sun and climate, water, ice, wind, gravity, they are the sculptors, relentlessly wearing everything down.
So the entire book is basically the story of that battle?
Yes, and it takes you through it systematically. It starts with the foundation tectonics, then it looks at how the materials are broken down weathering, and then it goes through each of the tools of destruction, rivers, glaciers, wind.
And it ends by bringing in biology and
yeah.
us, humanity.
Right. It culminates by showing how biology and now, critically, humanity have become the most dominant modern sculptors of all.
So the journey starts with tectonics. The book calls it setting the ultimate stage.
It's the perfect description. The movement of the tectonic plates creates the first order features. Mountain ranges, the vast, stable shields of continents, deep ocean basins.
This is the raw canvas that everything else works on.
It is. But before a river can carry a mountain away piece by piece, that mountain has to be turned into manageable pieces.
Which brings us to weathering.
The critical first step. It's the slow violence that breaks solid bedrock into smaller bits.
And the book breaks that down into three main types, right?
Yes, three types. The first is physical weathering.
Can you give us an analogy for that?
Sure. Imagine a crack in a sidewalk. Water gets in, then it freezes overnight. As it freezes, it expands. And that expansion forces the crack wider.
Like a pipe bursting in winter.
Exactly like that. That's frost shattering.
Right.
Or you could have salt crystals growing inside a porous rock, prying it apart from the inside. It's all mechanical.
Okay, that makes sense. What's next?
Then you have chemical weathering. This is about changing the rock's actual chemistry. Think about acid rain slowly dissolving a marble statue over many years.
Or rust.
Perfect example. The deep red and brown colors you see on rocks. That's oxidation. Rust. Water is chemically altering the rock.
And the third one is the one Viles specializes in.
Right. Biological weathering. The most obvious example is a tree root. It finds a tiny weakness in a rock. And as it grows, it acts like a powerful lever, just prying that rock apart.
So weathering is all about weakening the material, getting it ready to be moved.
Precisely. And once that material is weakened, gravity is always there, always pulling. Slopes are everywhere. And this is where the physics of it all gets really interesting. It's a constant tug of war.
A tug of war between what?
Between sheer stress, that's the force of gravity trying to pull everything downslope, and sheer strength, which is the internal resistance of the soil and rock holding it all together.
So as long as the strength is greater than the stress, the slope stays put.
Exactly. But if that balance changes, say the slope gets saturated with water or it's undercut by a river, then the stress can exceed the strength.
And you get failure. A landslide.
You get mass movement. And that can be anything from the incredibly slow, almost invisible downhill creep of soil over decades to catastrophic debris flows that can change a whole valley in just a few minutes.
Wow. Okay, so after gravity makes the first move, who's the next big player?
The single most important geomorphic agent on the planet. Rivers, fluvial systems.
They're like the planet's circulatory system.
That's a great way to put it. They carry all that broken down material away.
So how do they actually carve out those deep V-shaped valleys we see?
They have two main methods. First is hydraulic action. This is just the sheer force of the water itself, pushing against the banks, getting into cracks, and ripping out loose material.
Yeah, the second.
The second is abrasion. This is where the river uses its own sediment load, the sand, gravel, even boulders it's carrying, as a tool. It's like natural sandpaper, constantly grinding away at the bedrock.
You know, it's interesting. We always focus on what the river destroys, the canyons it cuts.
That's the dramatic image for sure.
But the book makes this brilliant point that the most important outcome might be the land it builds.
Ah, you're talking about deltas.
Yes, deltas. It focuses on them so heavily.
And for good reason. Deltas, like the enormous Ganges-Brahmaputra system, are just vast areas of new, super fertile land. They're built where the river slows down and drops all of its sediment into the sea, and they are incredibly sensitive to any changes happening upstream.
Let's shift from liquid water to solid ice. Glaciers. They leave a totally different signature on the landscape, don't they?
A completely different and very dramatic signature. Glaciers are just immensely powerful because of their scale and their weight.
And they erode differently, too.
Very differently. Their main weapon is plucking. This is where the ice at the base of the glacier freezes onto chunks of bedrock. And as the glacier moves, it just tears these massive blocks of rock away.
It literally plucks them out.
It does. And then there's abrasion. All those rock fragments that get embedded in the bottom of the ice act like, well, a giant sheet of sandpaper, miles long, grinding the valley floor smooth.
Which gives us those classic U-shaped valleys.
The U-shaped valleys, the armchair-shaped basins called cirques. You can see their handiwork all over the world from the Alps to Yosemite.
Okay, from cold to dry. Let's talk about wind, Aeolian processes.
This is the power of wind, especially in deserts or along coasts. Wind is obviously weaker than water or ice, but it is relentless, and it moves sediment in a particular way.
You don't see wind carrying boulders around.
No, you don't. The main transport method is called saltation. It's where sand grains don't fly high in the air, but instead bounce or skip along the surface.
And that skipping motion is what builds dunes.
That's what builds dunes, yes. Barchans, star dunes, all those iconic desert landforms. But the book also points to something else, loess. This is wind-blown silt, and the Loess Plateau in China is a perfect, massive example of its power. It's incredibly fertile, but also very easily eroded.
And this all leads us to the modern era, where Goody and Viles really bring the science home. Let's go back to biogeomorphology.
Right. And the key idea here is to challenge the old view that life is just a passenger on the landscape. It's not. Organisms are engineers.
And the star of the show is the beaver.
The beaver is the perfect example of what we call zoogeomorphology.
It all sounds like a cartoon, calling them geological agents.
It does, but their impact is enormous. By building dams, beavers completely transform valley floors. They slow the water, they trap huge amounts of sediment, they raise the water table, they fundamentally re-engineer the entire local system.
And that's just one animal.
Just one animal. Now think about the collective effect of all vegetation stabilizing slopes, or all the microbes helping to break down rock. It's immense.
Which brings us to the final and most overwhelming agent of change, us, the Anthropocene.
This is Goody's expertise, and the central claim is radical.
The claim that humans now move more earth than all natural processes combined. How is that even possible? What's the evidence?
The evidence is just in the numbers, in quantifying the scale. Human activities, mining, agriculture, construction now move more sediment every year than every river, glacier, and gust of wind on the planet combined.
Can you put that into perspective?
Well, think of the Amazon River, the mightiest river in the world. The amount of earth moved by human excavation is thought to be roughly double the amount of sediment the Amazon delivers to the ocean each year.
That is just staggering.
It is. We have become the planet's new dominant high-speed geomorphic force.
So after all that, construction, destruction, human intervention, what are the really big lessons, the takeaways?
I think the first one is the idea of dynamic systems and interconnection. Nothing happens in isolation.
The ripple effect.
The ripple effect is inescapable. If you build a huge dam upstream and trap all the sediment, you will absolutely see the consequences downstream.
Like the coast eroding away.
Exactly. The beach, maybe hundreds of miles away, gets starved of the sand it needs to replenish itself. It's all one system.
The second big theme has to be deep time. It's so hard for our brains to grasp.
It really is. We have to appreciate that these tiny, slow processes like chemical decay or the freeze-thaw cycle, in a single crack, produce monumental results when you let them run for millions of years.
The Grand Canyon wasn't carved in a weekend.
Not at all. It's the product of patient, relentless change over eons. And understanding that helps us realize that our rapid changes today will have consequences that last for a geological timescale.
And lurking behind all of this is the master control.
Climate. Climate is the master control. It decides which processes get to dominate in any given place. Where it's warm and wet, rivers rule. Where it's cold, ice takes over. Where it's dry, wind is king.
Which makes our current situation pretty sensitive.
It highlights just how sensitive the Earth's surface is to the rapid climate shifts we're causing. We are actively messing with the planet's master control panel.
You know, some of the ideas in the book just really stick with you. They perfectly summarize the whole perspective.
Oh, absolutely. The first one for me is this invitation. A landscape is a historical document. To a trained eye, the shape of a slope or a valley reveals a story of past climates and cataclysms.
It's a call to become an environmental detective. It turns every hike into a history lesson.
It really does. Then there's the summary of the fundamental conflict, the engine of it all.
The battle between building up and tearing down.
That's it. The fundamental conflict that shapes the Earth's surface is the battle between tectonics, which builds mountains up, and climate-driven erosion, which tears them down. That's the engine of landscape evolution right there.
And the final idea is the one that really forces a mental shift. It's the modern update to that whole story.
It's the new reality.
Yeah.
In the Anthropocene, the shovel, the plow, and the bulldozer have become geological forces that rival and often surpass the power of rivers and glaciers.
That one really forces us to see our own actions in a completely different light.
So all this knowledge isn't just academic. It has very direct practical uses.
Let's talk about safety. Yeah. Where is this science most critical?
Number one is natural hazard mitigation. You absolutely need to understand slope stability to do proper landslide zoning, to know where it's safe to build and where it isn't.
And for floods too, I imagine.
For sure. You need to understand fluvial dynamics for accurate flood prediction and to manage floodplains properly to give rivers the room they need.
And for building things, for civil engineering.
It's essential. Geomorphologists help site major infrastructure dams, bridges, pipelines, and stable locations. But even more importantly, they predict how that new structure will change the landscape.
That interconnectedness again.
Always. You have to ask, if we build this dam here, what happens to the sediment load downstream? Will it cause the river mouth to erode faster?
And this thinking even goes beyond Earth.
It does. Planetary scientists use these principles as analogs to understand landforms on Mars. When they see images of what look like ancient river valleys, they're applying the lessons of Goody and Viles to another world.
But I think the most important application is personal. It's that landscape literacy you talked about at the start.
I agree. You gain a whole new lens to see the world through. A trip to the beach is no longer just sand and waves. It's a dynamic system of energy, sediment transport, and change. You go from just seeing to understanding.
For me, what really stuck was that sobering theme of interconnection tied to the reality of the Anthropocene. To realize the decision made in a city planning office hundreds of miles away to build a road, to build a dam, sends these ripples through an entire geological system. And that those ripples now rival the great forces of nature. The book doesn't just teach you science. It confers a sense of responsibility.
It really does. For me, what resonated most was that profound sense of scale. Not just deep time, the millions of years, but also the scale of the microscopic. The idea that quiet chemical weathering by microbes or the slow expansion of a tiny salt crystal is fundamentally linked to carving canyons and shaping coastlines. It forces you to look both closer at the small things and much, much wider at the vastness of history.
You really do start seeing the world through the eyes of its new dominant agent. It's an indispensable guide for anyone living on this planet. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.